This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Maxine Crump, veteran journalist and activist, and she has some ideas about President Obama's second inauguration. It all begins today, and you'll hear it right here on WRKF. President Obama taking the oath of office for the second time after being elected with 51.1% of the votes last November. Also on the show, C.B. Forgotston, the veteran Capitol watcher, with some ideas to share regarding the indictment of former New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin and what's going on with the governor's tax reform proposal. It was floated 10 days ago, and to this point, the governor has not made a public statement. We'll discuss it with C.B. Forgotston. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a bit, we'll hear from Maxine Crump, veteran journalist and activist, on the inaugural of President Obama. And today, of course, is also Martin Luther King Day. The great civil rights leader died in 1968. He was only 39 years old, so we're coming up on the 45th anniversary of his assassination. And to put it in perspective, he has now been dead 6 years longer than he was alive. In 13 days, New Orleans will open its heart and its doors to people from all over the world coming to the Super Bowl as the Baltimore Ravens and the San Francisco 49ers face each other. As you've heard doubtless today, listening to WRKF, the game features brothers who are the opposing coaches. Jim Harbaugh, the more celebrated of the two brothers, is the coach of the 49ers, and he is leading his team to the Super Bowl, and San Francisco will be gunning for its sixth Super Bowl. One of those was won in New Orleans, 55-10 over Denver in 1990. And John Harbaugh is leading the Baltimore Ravens to the Super Bowl. He, unlike his brother, was not a star quarterback, was a journeyman assistant coach, and 10 years ago, he was the special teams coach at Indiana under former LSU boss Jerry DiNardo, who won just 8 games in 3 years at Indiana. So in 10 years, John Harbaugh has gone from a understudy at a poor program to the coach of a team poised to perhaps win the Super Bowl championship. A lot can happen in 10 years. 10 years ago, Barack Obama was an unknown state senator in Illinois, and now he is taking the oath of office for the second time, actually the fourth time, as President of the United States. The fourth time because it took 2 tries back in 2009. In fact, Kevin, do we have the first attempt by John Roberts to swear the president in? It didn't go so well 4 years ago.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear.
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Well, there was some concern that perhaps because it was butchered by Justice Roberts that the president really wasn't the president, so they did a redo in private. And so that was 2 oaths the president took 2 years, 4 years ago. And then because the inaugural is supposed to be on January 20th, which was yesterday, there was a private ceremony yesterday. And today, of course, as you will hear in a few hours on WRKF, there will be an extremely public ceremony involving the president of the United States, who takes the oath of office for the second time. And he does so as a popular president. He won the election by nearly 5 million votes. And to put his 2 victories in perspective, in the last century, only 3 presidents have had more than 51% of the votes in both elections in which they won. And, of course, in Franklin Roosevelt's case, it was 4 times. But the other 2, to accomplish this were Dwight Eisenhower and Barack Obama. Barack Obama has done something Ronald Reagan couldn't even do, and that's get 51% of the votes in two straight elections. And he is poised for another 4 years, which likely will be historic in our country's time. And the last 4 years were eventful. And with us to talk about this and much more is Maxine Crump. Good morning, Maxine.
Good morning, Jim.
How significant is it that a man of color has been elected twice in relative landslides? As I stated, Ronald Reagan didn't even get 51% of the votes when he ran against Jimmy Carter. Obama's done it twice, and only Dwight Eisenhower and Franklin Roosevelt have accomplished this in the last century.
How significant is it?
Yes, how significant is that?
It's astonishing, and I think the significance has a lot to do with our country. Barack Obama wasn't elected by black people, although he got 98% of African-American votes, but the country has seen a time and seen fit that this is the man that they want to lead him. And the people have spoken. And it's interesting, I heard Eric Cantor say, you know, he hopes that since the people have spoken, that they can come together and get something done now. And I'm thinking, I'm hoping he's meaning that, because if the majority of the people, we're still a we the people country, and if the majority says this is what we want, that's the way it usually goes.
Well, I'm sure it's remarkable for you and others, but in your life's journey here, less than 50 years ago, you were a trailblazer at LSU. You were the first African-American woman to live in a dorm on campus, weren't you?
That's right. And to call me a trailblazer, the 18-year-old that entered LSU was brought there by her father, who had blazed that trail in his mind a long time ago, because when I was growing up, I would hear him often say that he paid taxes for LSU, mm-hmm. and that his children couldn't go to school there. And so it wasn't right to him. And so he had always had the idea that the democracy not being for us, was a problem. And he always lived like it. And he always spoke of it to me vividly. So when it came time to, in the summer of 63, when the desegregation ruling was made to desegregate LSU, it was a case of Dr. Dupuy Anderson suing LSU to desegregate, and in the name of his daughter, Freya Anderson. And so that's how LSU was desegregated. So when my dad asked me that summer, I had graduated high school, he asked me, I'd already registered to go to Southern. He said, would you like to go to LSU? And I said, yes, because immediately it came in my mind, I'll get to take advantage of all the taxes Dad had paid to LSU.
So the summer of 64 was 64, when you enrolled, and you were at which residence hall?
Louise Garrick.
Which is still there.
It's still there, and I was in a private room, and I just heard from
that by design?
Well, I'll tell you what one of the students said just recently. A friend of mine who knows someone who lived in my dorm, I don't remember her, but and I have not talked with her, but she told a friend of mine that hall monitor or whoever that was, but the dorm...
Resident assistant or whatever.
Yeah, said to them in that dorm that I was a communist spy. So if you think that means it was by design, I don't know. Also, a Latin American student from Colombia asked mm-hmm. to be my roommate, and she was asked when she went over to women's housing if she knew that I was black, and she said to them, of course. She did not get the
room. Well, Latin American students had gone to LSU for many years. Mm-hmm. In fact, at one time, there was a Latin American fraternity there exclusively for Hispanic students. But and this was back in the 40s. But in 1964, Maxine Crump was the first African-American female, believe it or not, to be a resident at an LSU dormitory. Now, the president, our president, was alive. He was a young man in Hawaii at this time. All of this has occurred in his lifetime, from the fact that blacks were essentially banned from a major university in a state in America, and by the way, Louisiana was not exclusive. And then 50 years later, less than 50 years later, he's taking the oath of office for the second time as President of the United States.
And I'm glad you said Louisiana is not exclusive, because very often people say that the South is exclusive in its segregated practices. The South had the signs. The North, mm-hmm. you had to figure it out. and the West. Barack Obama ran his administration very much like he had really embodied every bit of that, even though some of it he was too young to actually know he was experiencing. But he seems to have an understanding of the country that takes in all of what the country is about, all of its character assets as well as flaws.
Well, he is poised to take the oath a second time as President of the United States, and the honeymoon was very brief, if he had a honeymoon at all.
If at all.
From day one, Mitch McConnell and other Republicans said, our goal is to defeat him in 2012. It did not happen, and many thought it would. In fact, I was skeptical about his reelection chances for a long time, but yet he won, and he not only won, he won by nearly 5 million votes. How did he do it?
I think they underestimated a ground game. In the old days of politics, all they had was a ground game. And I don't think they were watching the ground game with Barack Obama. Or they knew it, but they think, well, you know, that's the old days, the ground game. But in Barack Obama's case, I think there was no other way he would have won it than the ground game, because many of the people, and I heard it on your show, that Louisiana has more registered Democrats than Republicans, far more. Mm-hmm. But it's getting the vote out. And so I think the Barack Obama campaign knew that there were lots of votes out there, but it was getting them to the polls. Just like the CATS tax that passed, the Capillary Transit tax that passed, that's how they passed it, by the ground game, because there are a lot of people who wanted to pass the tax, but who might not have gone out to vote unless someone encouraged them to really go out to vote. So I think the ground game did it.
297-5633, if you'd like to join us. Maxine Crump, she is president and CEO of Dialogue on Race in Louisiana, and we will talk with her about that program, which has taken a new life. But here in Louisiana, the president got 41% of the votes. He got over 51% nationally, so we're about 10% behind the national average. And that's in a state where there's an overwhelming minority of African Americans. About 32% of the people in this state are African American. And the president received most of the votes from black people, but in Louisiana, still probably only 20% at the most of white voters. How do you explain this chasm in our state?
Louisiana, the people in Louisiana still are the people. There's an original passing on of the heritage here, because Louisiana didn't have its people didn't migrate like other areas, except for the black people who migrated out of the Jim Crow oppression. But many of the people who stayed, in a sense, still have the feeling of, I'm holding on to my culture. I'm holding on to my state. I'm holding on to my country. And I think people who have the intense hold on to the country and land and state feel that change is bad for them. And
so race is involved.
Race is definitely involved, because the hold on to the state has to do with keeping the state the way it was, which was segregated and white, and keeping blacks in their place. And I'll say that very often a lot of people who are white talk to me, particularly when I say I'm with Dialogue on Race, the talk really starts. So I get to hear a lot now. And a lot of whites really like mm-hmm. a lot of blacks as people. But the way they describe them says, in my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, of course you like him. He's non-threatening, or her, she's non-threatening. But someone equal is another problem for them.
We'll talk more about this and Dialogue on Race in Louisiana on Martin Luther King Day and the second inauguration day of President Barack Hussein Obama. Maxine Crump is with us, 297-5633, back after this 90-second timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your number, wherever you are, 877-217-5757. If you'd like to join us as we continue our discussion with Maxine Crump. Many remember Maxine as a reporter for 15 years. She covered all kinds of events for WAFB, and she is now president and CEO of Dialogue on Race in Louisiana. And this is an appropriate day to talk with her as we approach in a few hours the second inauguration of President Barack Obama, who, as I stated, is the first Democrat since Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944 to get more than 51% of the votes in two straight presidential elections. And the last Republican to do it was Dwight Eisenhower. But to think of the Democrats who have come after President Roosevelt. We had Truman, we had Johnson, we had Kennedy then Johnson, Jimmy Carter, of course, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, and yet he is the champion when it comes to the ability to win elections, and he has done it with relative ease, 51% of the votes against Mitt Romney, who got 47%, and we will go to the phone lines in just a moment, but we talked about in Louisiana where he received only 41% of the votes. In Baton Rouge, he received better than the national average, over 52% of the votes in the city of Baton Rouge, which is still majority white. How do you explain the fact that the president did so well in East Baton Rouge Parish?
They're not all from East Baton Rouge Parish. So many more people have moved into Baton Rouge now, and the culture is changing as to who is Baton Rouge now. And that's what I was talking about earlier. Those who are Louisiana born and bred and generations are here tend to hold on to the way things are. And the status quo in their mind is just that they've just never seen, they can't really imagine a Baton Rouge where whites aren't running things. Black mayor does not mean that he's running the city. That may be controversial.
Well, that's
to say,
another thing is that the mayor Holding got 60% of the votes.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great guy and he's smart and he's doing a great job. And I think people wanted a change from politics as usual, and they saw an answer in Mayor Kip Holden, and he's delivering.
297-5633 is your number. And, Kevin, I think you're going to have to do it the old-fashioned way and as far as alerting me to the callers. Kevin Gallagher producing today, and we will go to some folks who are waiting to talk with Maxine Crump on Inauguration Day for President Barack Obama, 51 years old. Much to go in his life, and to think at the age of 55, he will be put out to pasture. President Clinton was much younger. He was only, I guess he was 54 when he left office, or almost 54. But the President of the United States has much to do in his second term. What do you think the major initiatives will be in term number two for the president?
I think it's going to be gun control, and immigration.
Gun control?
Yeah. Now, or gun legislation.
Well, it won't be called gun control.
No, it won't be That's called gun control. It'll be new policies on guns.
And by the way, I'm told that 75,000 people were at the Lamar Dixon Center this weekend for a gun show.
Yes. That's called the last hurrah. They're going to get all the guns and stock them away because they think the Second Amendment is threatened. Now, that's kind of something, and we're going to look back in history, and the kids of several generations down are going to say, you're kidding, right? What were they afraid of? It's really going to look like, I don't know, like a King Kong movie, something that people aren't going to believe could really happen, that people would be reacting like this about guns and about the Second Amendment and about protecting themselves. What are we so afraid of?
Well, I think it's a carryover from the election. These people who go to these shows are overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. And many of them aren't in the best physical condition, and this is a way of expression as far as masculinity and protection. And
protection of what? Protecting whiteness?
Protection of their own masculinity, I think.
Masculine, white, male, Protestant.
Catholic,
we're back to
Jewish.
That. Yeah.
I don't know that religion enters this, but other things certainly do. And gender is a big part, and there's, I'm sure, some racial aspects to it. But there, that said, there were some women and some black folks who were at the Lamar Dixon Center over the weekend too.
Well, I would like
and
to
some
say-
people, I think, have legitimate concerns about their safety. We live in a violent state.
That's true, but I think that the fear is out of proportion, and I think that what they think they're losing, they're not going to lose. Those who are reasonably just want guns for protection, they could have gotten those without this rush on guns. But this rush on guns is about some out of proportion fear. And it's not, the fear isn't real. And if this country is coming more into balance that it should have come, where all of its citizens are full participants in this democracy, if they're afraid that it's going to become out of proportion, it's been out of proportion the other way. It's now coming more into alignment, what it should have been all along, that we should really live up to what we who we say we are. And that's what Martin Luther King asked, live out the true meaning of its creed. For all these years, we have been able to say to people of color, you do not live in this democracy the way whites do. Whites get the full privileges, and you get what we say you get. That's not a real America. That's not a country that we all could really wrap our arms around and say we're very happy to say that's who we are. But we're coming more into that now. So if that's the fear of losing an out of proportion fact of how our country has operated, and now it's coming into more alignment, and they fear they're losing something or gaining something, a better country.
Okay, 2975633, Maxine Crump, opinionated as ever, and we're glad to get her opinions now. Jim on Airline writes, the number of the physicians in the U.S. is 700,000. Accidental deaths caused by physicians per year, 120,000. The number of gun owners, 80 million. Accidental deaths, 1,500 in the U.S. So he writes, statistically, doctors are 9,000 more times more dangerous than gun owners. Remember, guns don't kill people. Doctors do.
Well, I like people who look up valuable information to help us put things in proportion. In perspective here.
Mike on Sherwood. Mike, good morning. You're on with Maxine.
Hi, Maxine and Jim.
Hi.
A couple of things. First, I wanted to offer a minor correction that the only people that were forcefully migrated to Louisiana were the blacks. I think there were some Acadians that were forcefully migrated at some point. Second, that may explain some of the divide in Louisiana. I think the Catholic Church has actively worked to become more conservative over time, those of us who grew up Catholic and were liberal-minded probably have voted with our feet, and abortion is still a big issue in this state. But at, I'm trying to remember what your last point was about the
You gave us something to work with, so thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. About the Acadians, many were brought here without their consent.
Okay, the migration that I was talking about was the migration of blacks out of the South because of the Jim Crow laws of oppression.
Because they had to get out to find a better life elsewhere.
They thought they were going to a better place in the North and the West.
Well, when you go up the, just since we're in a football crazy state, the first black football player at LSU to play for the Tigers on the varsity was Mike Williams, 1972. Go one state up, it was John Richardson for Arkansas, 1970. The one who did it at Missouri was 1956. In Iowa, it was 1896. So the farther north you go, the more blacks had a chance to do things.
Very true. The barriers were very different. Racism operated in America all over, but the barriers were not the same, and they weren't as tenacious as they were here in the Deep South.
There were other issues in play, other in addition to race, in the presidential election, and we heard Mike mention abortion. Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. Mitt Romney and Bobby Jindal and almost every prominent Republican is on the record as stating they would like to overturn the Roe v. Wade decision. Most all Democrats outside of the Deep South are of a different mind. Mary Landrieu has a different opinion about that. She believes Roe v. Wade should be the law of the land. What do you think about this being a political issue that still resonates 30 years after the Supreme Court ruled in favor of abortion rights in America?
It's a part of that same entitlement that says who gets to name what. And it has been white and male predominantly. And so the control of what is the entitlement of what white and males get to control is changing. And that landscape has a lot of people holding on to things that they thought they had a right to determine. And that is what a woman does with her body is a part of that as well.
297-5633 for Maxine Crump, Chad and Baker. Chad, you're on the air with Maxine.
Oh, good morning, Ms. Angster, and also to your guests. On this day of a service, I would like to focus in, as you said, with Baton Rouge as a urban center. Could you talk about the still divide of race and class? Mostly you could see it visibly along Florida Boulevard, and how, and also, can you talk more about how someone can get involved in your organization, Dialogue on Race?
All right.
Oh, great. I'm glad you asked about becoming a participant in Dialogue on Race. The Dialogue on Race series is a 6-week series that is an educational process for how to talk about race. It's an honest dialogue in a safe setting, and it's facilitated. And we use scholarly articles for each session. The first session focuses on definitions, because if you don't define what it is you're talking about, then it's kind of a bull session. You're kind of all over the place. So we define our terms, and we get clear as to what we're talking about. We don't ask anyone to agree to the definitions, and sometimes they don't, but rarely do they stay with their definition throughout the 6 weeks. But they are given that option. In the second session, we talk about who benefits from racism, because in my lifetime, that was always the confusion to me. Who benefits from racism? And then I finally learned through programs that taught how race was constructed. It was constructed into the American system that said there are those who are able to be full beneficiaries of American rights and privileges, and others just don't seem to be. And they were determined to be categories for them. And the rest of us were put into the categories called race. And that's the construction. And those who were the beneficiaries, the full beneficiaries of the full rights and privileges of America are white. And that's how that system was set up. And so then now we know what we're talking about. And so we talk about white privilege. And then in the third session, we talk about how the system operates to keep white privilege in place and to limit access to other people of color. And then the next one we talk about is the movement led by Martin Luther King that worked to roll back this discrimination and this racial divide that was constructed into our country. And then we talk about what's left, what we can learn from it and what's left to do about it. Then we talk about a measure that was put in place, the Affirmative Action Amendment, to level the playing field. And we talk about how it's worked and how it hasn't worked and whether we still need it. And then we talk about talk is action. And so why talking about it helps to eliminate it.
And for those who would like to participate in the dialogue, what's the best way to contact you and those who are participants?
Info@dialogueonracelouisiana.org.
Okay. Maxine Crump. And I misspoke a moment ago, but tomorrow's the 40th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, and it's still an issue in America 40 years later. January 22nd, 1973, the Roe v. Wade decision came down. Lyndon Johnson died on that day, and George Foreman won the heavyweight championship over Joe Frazier in Kingston, Jamaica.
You're an amazing encyclopedia.
That was a big day in American history, but yeah. The Roe v. Wade decision is the one that's still an issue all these years later.
Indeed.
Now, the Dialogue on Race series, one of the things that you focus upon, you say there's a distinction between prejudice and racism.
Yes.
What's the distinction?
Very often people use prejudice and racism interchangeably. Prejudice is an attitude that a person has against another person, and that can be anybody can be racially prejudiced. A person of color can be prejudiced against someone white, or someone white can be prejudiced against someone of color, or many other prejudices. But racial prejudice is about how you feel about each other's race. Racism is the construction that I described, the construction that America set up, and it's still in place. And it's not always in place intentionally, and it's not always in place directly. And it's not because they're mm-hmm. bad white people. It's because the construction was set up and it's still operating. And most businesses operate the way they do because it works well for them. And they just, most of the time, just have see no need to fool with changing things because mm-hmm. they're making money. Businesses are in to make money. So a lot of times it's indirect and unintentional. But it still has the result of having barriers if you are of another color.
Now, we're going to get to CB for Godston in our last segment this hour, but Ben on Goodwood says that he takes exception to the reason President Obama got 41% of the total votes in Louisiana because of race. He says if it were because of race, Bobby Jindal would not have been elected governor twice because he is darker than is the president.
Well, the good news is that I wasn't the one who said that, so I...
No. But the fact is, we do have a man of color who is
right.
governor of Louisiana.
He said that,
at least I think he said, the president was not voted, did not receive the same amount of votes in Louisiana for other reasons other than race, because we have elected a person of color as our governor twice.
Well, I think that a lot of people voted for Barack Obama because he's smart, he's capable, and they
But what about Louisiana?
In Louisiana, I think the same thing. I think they did. And I don't think that that his color was the reason that he was voted for. I think we're very excited that a man who's black is that capable, that intelligent, and that much of an inspiration for all of us.
Well, Bobby Jindal is a man of color, but if he were a Democrat, would he have been able to receive the overwhelming support that he has from white people in Louisiana? Is it a party affiliate?
Not with the same message.
No?
No. He would have had to have a different message.
So there are factors that go beyond race, obviously.
Definitely.
But there are still some people, not only in Louisiana, but all over the country, who will vote on that one issue, too, one way or the other.
I don't think there are as many as people think who vote that way. Because I can tell you what, if you think blacks vote for blacks, if Herman Cain had run, I don't think blacks would have voted for
Herman Cain. For Herman Cain?
Yeah. If he had been the nominee.
Not in large numbers,
no.
And black people have been more accustomed to voting for whites than whites for blacks.
Absolutely.
Lindy Boggs was elected over and over and over in New Orleans, as was Harry Connick and others with a black...
As is Barry Landrieu.
Well, but she doesn't have a black majority. Her brother does, though.
Yes.
Mitch, and he won going away. Well, thank you, Maxine. Thank you for joining us today, and let's talk again soon.
Okay.
And we'll be back with Capital Watcher C.B. for Godston after this 1.5-minute timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And we're joined by C.B. for Godston, Capital Watcher, and a man with opinions about various matters in our lives, and in particular, the budget situation is always something C.B. follows closely. He was the former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee. Good morning to you, C.B. for Godston.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on, Jim.
And you can find out more about CB and his opinions by going to forgodston.com. What's your early read on the governor's tax reform proposal?
I would say that half of it might pass. it's first of all, Jim, it's hard to judge because it's only a half a plan at this point. And Jindal, as he usually does, gets what puts out the part that the public likes. And people are mostly hearing income tax repeal and sales tax. And they say, oh, that's the average person in this state, I think, says, oh, income taxes are bad, sales taxes are good because they're fair, everybody has to pay them. And so that it's pandering. So the interesting thing about this is that Jindal is pandering to the masses and talking about repeal of the income tax, which only takes a majority vote of the legislature, by the way. The hard part and the part that we don't know anything about is what's going to replace it. He's thrown things out like increasing the sales tax. Well, just running the numbers on that, he would have to increase the sales tax to offset on a revenue-neutral basis by 6 cents. Well, the public says, well, that ain't going to work. What about maybe property tax? No, that's off the table. Well, then how are you going to generate $3 billion to repeal the corporate and personal income tax and the corporate franchise tax, actually $3.3 billion. And they say, well, we'll broaden the base. Okay, that sounds like a nice statement, put more people into the mix paying the sales tax. But what that involves is really gets to the tough part. And remember, to increase the state sales tax or to broaden the base, which means adding things that are not currently taxed, or removing tax exemptions, would require two-thirds vote of the legislature. So at this point, he's trying to start a stampede to get a majority vote to repeal the income taxes, and he's basically going to dump it in the legislators' pockets, in their laps, to figure out a way how to offset that. Otherwise, they've got to cut the budget by, actually, it would be $4.5 billion, because in addition to the $3.3 billion that would be lost by repealing the income tax and the franchise tax, he has a $1.2 billion shortfall for the fiscal year beginning July 1. So what that would mean is the legislators, by majority vote, could easily get rid of the income tax, but then they've got to find something to make up for $4.5 billion in revenues. Otherwise, they have to cut the budget.
All right. Treasurer Kennedy was on this program last week. He said this would eventually have to go to a vote of the people. He believes it's a constitutional change. The Jindal people apparently do not believe that. They're going to try to do this with legislative action rather than with legislative action and a vote of the people, perhaps a concern that they would meet the same fate that Buddy Romer did in 1989. You're a lawyer. What do you think? Can this be done without going to the electorate?
Yes. And I suspect that Treasurer Kennedy has more information than I do. And in broadening the income tax base, he may be considering the exemptions that are locked into the Constitution. Or he may be talking about what a lot of people are talking about, is having to push the cost of government down to the locals, which would mean lowering the homestead exemption. But I agree with you that they don't want to take a chance with the public. And the more people I talk to, legislators, lobbyists, and others, it's pretty clear that they're going to avoid any constitutional amendment because that would probably be tied all together and the public would have an up or down vote. And if they see their taxes are going to rise as a result of their vote, they'd probably vote it down. So, yes, it can easily be done by statute. It still takes a two-thirds vote of the legislature to raise the tax, to do the tough part.
877-217-5757 for CB for Godston. HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on with CB. Hi, HB.
Good morning. Thank you. CB, just one question. basically speaking, in the terms of Mr. Kennedy, we need a savings account for the state. We need to not spend more money than we've got coming in. Is this country and our state, as compared to the bankruptcy laws connected with businesses or individuals, are we, as a nation and a state, really technically bankrupt? Thank you, sir.
I think you would say we were because of the debt and the cash flow. But that's not going to happen because the federal government can print money. The state government can't, but I just don't think that, that we're set for bankruptcy, because one of the reasons what HB, and I assume that this is one of the things he's talking about, is that we have a $19 billion unfunded accrued liability in our state pension plan, which is not being addressed any longer by Governor Jindal. And so when you put all your debts and say if they came due, what would could you pay all of them with your cash flow? And the answer would be no. You might not be in Chapter 7, but you would certainly want to go in Chapter 11. But Chapter 13 is what governmental bodies go into, and it's basically a workout plan. And I don't think anybody wants that to happen, conservatives or liberals.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757 for CB for Godston. Todd wants to know why we don't have a revenue secretary in Louisiana right now.
Because it would be illegal to pay the revenue secretary as much as the executive council of the Department of Revenue. The Secretary of Revenue cannot be paid at the level that Tim Barr is. So I assume that position will just remain either vacant, or I'm not sure if former Representative Jane Smith doesn't still occupy that position. But the primary reason that we don't have a that Tim Barfield is not the Secretary of Revenue is that he would not be allowed to be paid as much as he is. The question then becomes, which I have not seen anything in the media or anywhere, is Jane Smith still the Secretary of Revenue?
That's a good question, and I'm not
maybe
sure.
Maybe you can get that tracked down, Jim, because, she was appointed Secretary of Revenue. I hadn't heard anything about her resigning. You just don't hear from her anymore. But she was making about $140,000-$150,000 a year in that position.
And Barfield is the one who's running the show over there.
That it would seem that way. It's always interesting to me how they keep just referring to him as the executive council, but they don't explain who the Secretary of Revenue is. I actually hadn't looked on the website to see who is. I don't know what position Jane Smith may occupy. She was the legislative liaison who was moved up to Secretary of Revenue after they fired the then Secretary of Revenue for following the law.
You're talking about Cynthia Bridges.
Cynthia Bridges, followed the law on the alternative vehicle tax, which is exactly as I read the law, that it applies to all vehicles that can run on ethanol. That's virtually all of them these days. And so they fired her for doing her job. Of course, she landed on her feet, got an even better job in California.
This is a press release that may answer the question you proffered, CB. It says, Governor, this was back in August, by the way, Governor Bobby Jindal announced today that Tim Barfield will serve as Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Revenue beginning in October. The governor said Barfield will lead the administration's efforts to reform Louisiana's tax system, which will be the governor's top priority in the 2013 legislative session. Jane Smith will return to her role as deputy secretary of the Department of Revenue. So apparently she...
But I don't know that that's happened, Jim. They keep very carefully referred to him as the council.
Yeah, he is not. He is definitely not the...
So maybe we don't have a Secretary of Revenue, only a Deputy Secretary and a Council. I just think that I'd like to see it clarified, and maybe after I get off the air with you, I'll at least look on their website to see if that would, or make a make an inquiry over there, although not likely.
Well, in the overall scheme, though, is it really that big of a deal?
No, it's just that it's a good question to raise why. It's a legal maneuver so that they could pay Barfield more, that's all. And that's from a guy who's, you know, always talking about we got to downsize government and make it smaller and, you know, and bragging about the number of employees he's laid off. Well, he lays them off at the bottom, but to keep up in the salaries, and Treasury Kennedy's pointed out that while they have laid off maybe 3,000 employees since Bobby Jindal's been governor, the payroll has gone up by $600 million. So if the generally you think if the idea of laying off employees is to reduce the size of the payroll, but that hadn't happened because they keep paying those that are there, particularly at the top, much more.
Lynn and Melrose. Lynn, you're on with CB. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim and CB. So far, I've been on Christmas. It's a very depressing conversation, and the state is facing some really real problems. But an additional one that the governor has supported without any clue where the money would come from is the big coastal restoration program, which a $50 billion program for which the state would be responsible for about a third, and they want to build this big, what I call the big sand berm below Houma, $13 billion, really mistake project. And I mean, I'm just thinking, how does anybody get away with promising these things, knowing that there's nothing, no way to pay for them?
CB?
Well, I can't explain politicians, but they always overpromise and underdeliver. I mean, that's up to us as citizens to stop electing people if we don't believe what they're saying. But let me mention that Lynn raises an interesting point about coastal restoration. The state is about to come into a few billion dollars from BP, from the settlement, from the criminal and civil activities and everything surrounding the BP oil spill. And a lot of people believe, because they've heard that money is all going to coastal restoration. So I assume somebody would answer his question and say, oh, we got the money from BP coming in to do this. But here's the most interesting thing, and here's Bobby Jindal's secret supply of funds to balance the budget. That money this new BP money is not dedicated constitutionally to the coastal restoration. A lot of talk about it, and that's supposedly the purpose of it, but it's like the tobacco money going for smoking cessation, and it's going for other things. But this is not even locked into the Constitution. This money will flow to the state, and we have this, you know, at least a $1.2 billion shortfall. And people keep saying, well, why would Bobby Jindal want to preside over a state that doesn't have any money? Well, he's about to get a big windfall. And given, you know, the current climate at the state capitol, I suspect the legislators will take that money very easily and with the majority vote spend it on balancing the state budget as opposed to coastal restoration. And I merely point that out to be for those who are really concerned about coastal restoration, and we all are or should be, but it's not what you think. And that kind of goes back to the original question of promising things that we don't have the money.
All right. Quickly, Ray Nagin, what's your thinking about his indictment?
Very sad, very disappointing. A classic example of power corrupting and people coming into office. And I knew Ray long before he got to be mayor.
You support him?
Yes, I did. His first term, not for his second term. I was just like everybody else. I didn't support him in the primary. I support him in the runoff. Supported Jim Singleton in the primary. But I watched, and I had many chances to sit down and talk with him, not necessarily one-on-one, but in very small, quiet setting. And I thought he was the real thing, and I'm supposed to be a world-class cynic. And I truly believe that the power and the pressure and all just really got to him. And, you know, not excusing him, he should do the time. I mean, he is corrupt. So it was a huge disappointment to me, and I didn't support him his second time. I thought he made a mess of Katrina and said so very publicly, for which I was blasted as being a racist, but be that as it may, it is what it is, and he is what he is now.
We only have 5 seconds. Who's the next president of LSU?
Stephen Morey.
Thank you, CB, for Godston. Always a pleasure. Let's talk again. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. Thanks.
Take care. And happy Martin Luther King Day to everybody within earshot. And please stay tuned. WRKF will carry the inaugural festivities throughout the day, beginning right after this program. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.